Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's Here and Now. Threats of new al-Qaeda attacks on American soil, but also offers of a truce in Afghanistan and Iraq, both emerge from a new audio tape purportedly from Osama bin Laden.
The war in Iraq is ongoing relentlessly, and the operations in Afghanistan are escalating all the time, and your dead and injured are increasing all the time.
The Arabic language network Al Jazeera aired portions of the tape today. Experts have yet to confirm if the voice is indeed bin Laden. This new tape comes more than a year since the last one from bin Laden, and as Pakistani authorities say, a recent CIA strike there killed al-Qaeda weapons experts. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Los Angeles Times correspondent Josh Meyer. And Josh, as we said, the tape still has to be verified, but what's your educated guess? Is this him, do you think?
Hi, Robin. I think it probably is him. I mean, even if you can't get a voice print on it right away, it's certainly the kind of wording that bin Laden has used in the past, a lot of reference, holy references and so on and so forth. And I think it's rather remarkable what he said in terms of striking a very conciliatory tone almost, threatening attacks, of course, but also offering a truce that he describes as being fair and long term.
What do you read into that? Other analysts have said that they think it's in relation to the Pakistan attacks, that usually it's Zawahiri, the bin Laden deputy, who issues the tapes, and that bin Laden may be issuing this one may be a sign that he felt some pain from that strike.
Well, you know, there's always a lot of speculation when you get into these things. My personal opinion is that it is not related to the attack because it takes too long for these videos or, audios to get produced and delivered to the right people. But because it is an audio tape, it could have been something that was done more quickly. Whatever the case, I think bin Laden is trying to re-exert his influence over the al-Qaeda movement. As we know, Zawahiri has done all of the tapes, at least for the past year.
In fact, the speaker does say new attacks are being planned on American soil. Your thoughts?
Well, he's been saying that for years, too. It's fairly unnerving, I know, for federal counterterrorism officials when he says something like that, because they do have deep concerns that there are sleeper cells here that have been sort of burrowed down and invisible for several years. So they're very concerned about that. But again, what I thought was different about this is the fact that he is offering a truce that's fair and long-term, quote, so that we can build Iraq and Afghanistan. He says there is no shame in the solution because it prevents wasting of billions of dollars to merchants of war. Now, this is the same person who in the past has gloated over the fact that attacks have cost the United States billions of dollars. In fact, one thing that people often miss is that it's not just the casualties in terms of lives taken, but also the millions of dollars spent that al-Qaeda has been trying to achieve. So it seems a bit of a reversal there.
Well, and I'm wondering about that before we let you go. Do you think that's, in fact, because of a backlash from Iraqis, from those in the region who are angry about the attacks?
It's very possible, Robin. I mean, one of the things that he also said, if indeed it is him, which I thought was very striking to me, is that he said, based on what I have said, it is better not to fight Muslims on their land. And I don't remember him specifically articulating that, but that's clearly a reference to the fact that Muslim women and children have been killed in some of these al-Qaeda attacks, particularly in Iraq. So he may be backpedaling on that a bit.
Right. Josh Meyer, Washington correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, on a new audio tape reportedly from Osama bin Laden that aired on Al Jazeera television. Josh, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
And this note, Al Jazeera also aired new images of American journalist Jill Carroll last night. She was kidnapped in Baghdad on January 7th. In the silent video, she's surrounded by armed guards. Carroll's mother, Mary Beth, appeared on CNN today with an urgent plea for her daughter's release.
I, her father, and her sister are appealing directly to her captors to release this young woman who has worked so hard to show the suffering of Iraqis to the world.
According to Al Jazeera, the kidnappers have threatened to kill Carroll by tomorrow unless U.S. authorities agree to release all women detainees in Iraq. Today, the Iraqi government is recommending that 6 of 8 Iraqi females in military custody be released, but they deny this is in reaction to the captors' demands. Meantime, a Sunni Arab leader and several Muslim clerics have condemned the kidnapping in Iraq, and the Washington-based Council on American-Islamic Relations is sending a delegation to Iraq to appeal for Carroll's release. Earlier today in Tel Aviv, a Palestinian suicide bomber wounded at least 15 when he blew himself up at a fast food stand. Amidst that violence, Palestinians are preparing for parliamentary elections next week, and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon remains in a coma following a stroke. His legacy is in limbo as well. Will he be remembered as the fearsome warrior who saved that country in the 67 war and again in 73? Or as a man who managed to find a path to peace that had eluded previous leaders? Will he be thought of as the man hated by Arabs and many Israelis for his ruthless tactics in the Lebanon War? Or as the man who laid the groundwork for a Palestinian state? Ari Shavit is a columnist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. His article in this week's New Yorker, entitled The General, recounts his exclusive, often intimate conversations with Ariel Sharon over the last 6 years. And Ari joins us from the studios of the Jerusalem Post in Israel. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you write at the beginning that as far back as you can remember, you remember Ariel Sharon. What was your first memory of him?
Well, for all of us Israelis, he was always a problematic, controversial war hero. In many ways, Israel's General MacArthur, a person who doesn't quite take orders, who's not quite obedient to the democratic elected government, and who tends to be brutal and sometimes uses force when it's not needed. Throughout, I think there was this deep ambivalency of someone that you had to respect in a way, but you felt distrust and even at times real moral outrage. Definitely during the Lebanon War, my generation of liberal Israelis saw Sharon as a real political demon. For me, and again, my generation, in many ways, as I say in this piece in The New Yorker, we defined ourselves politically vis-a-vis Sharon, especially because of the war in Lebanon and because of the settlements. Sharon represented everything that we were afraid of in the new Israel.
But then, as you write, you met him. I want to just go back to that first meeting for a moment. Late summer of 1999, he was 71 years old, and at that time, an irrelevant old general. He was not yet prime minister. He talked about many things, the inner strength his love of the land gave him. And you say he defined himself as a Jew and not an Israeli.
Yes. First of all, the shock, taking into account all that I've just said, the shock was to really discover the Sharon charm. This person who seemed to be brutal and who was brutal throughout most of his life, personally, was a real charmer. Then there was really the depth of his philosophy. As I say in the piece, in many ways, he was not Jewish because he was a man with no messiah but with strong roots. While most of Jews are people with roots that are not that strong but with a very strong messianic sense this way or the other. And he was someone who was very realistic, even pessimistic about, very cruel in his perception of reality, really not idealistic whatsoever in any way, but with a very, very strong sense of the land. Someone with sincere, I would say almost naive, even almost childish beliefs in the land and in the way his relationship with the land. And this was no spin. If one of the elements of the success of Mr. Sharon later on when he became prime minister was, I think, that he radiated something quite authentic in this age of postmodern politics, of when we are so used to everything being so polished by the spin doctors and by television. He was someone who was not attractive in any way, who was not eloquent in any way, but carried with him a sense of authenticity, in the sense kind of an old world politics.
Well, and in April 2001, you do go back to his home, Sycamore Ranch, after he was elected prime minister. You were the first journalist he granted a comprehensive interview to. And the question then was whether there was a new Sharon, whether he had changed from a man of war to a man of peace. And you asked him specifically if he was interested in being an Israeli de Gaulle. De Gaulle, of course, made peace with the Algerians and ended that war. What did he say?
Absolutely not. He was very, very, very hawkish, very, very hardcore right-wing politics. He said he will never evacuate the settlements. He talked specifically about the settlements, which 4 years later, he did evacuate in the Gaza Strip. He said how essential each one of them was. He said there was logic and necessity in each one of them, which these are settlements he himself had a part in putting there. Mm. And he said that he, in many ways, reflected the positions that are totally contradictory to what he did years later. He said there's no way to separate Israelis from Palestinians. There's no way to build a barrier that would separate Israelis from Palestinians. No way to split Jerusalem. No way to evacuate settlements. He was very much the old Sharon, saying the conflict will never end.
So, Ari Shavit, what changed? Because you met with him again in 2003, 2005. What changed Ariel Sharon?
This is really the great mystery. I'll say that Mr. Sharon left behind him two great mysteries. One is really the secret of his power, because in many ways, he was a limited person. He was not a genius in any way. There was nothing overwhelming, impressive about him. And yet his record, for better and for worse, over the 50 years, is an amazing one. The second Sharon mystery is really the conversion. It happened sometime during 2003. My guess, or my hypothesis, is that a lot has to do with the influence of his sons and the ones close to him. Until he got into office, he was very close to his wife, who helped very much to build up this tough guy fighting the world and feeling justice is absolutely on his side. Under the influence of his sons, he came to a dialogue with pragmatic Israel, with the business community, with America. He realized that the world is not the world he thought it was before. And in this sense, in his mid-70s, he suddenly grew up. He matured very, very late. And this brought him to a new concept, which I think was not totally coherent. I don't think that he himself has actually produced a new overall approach or a new ideology. But he realized he must change, and he thought that it's better that he would make the Israeli concessions rather than to leave it to the younger Israeli politicians whom he didn't trust. To give Israel a border, even if the price is very high, would be his legacy. And he fell in love with this idea gradually and was willing to act on it rather decisively and courageously.
Ari Shavit, a left-leaning columnist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, who found himself one of the favored interviewers of Ariel Sharon in the last 6 years. Ari's fascinating article about their conversations appears in this week's New Yorker. When we come back, we'll ask Ari, what does he think the future of Israel is without Ariel Sharon, the man he once thought was a demon? Also, this program note, later we're going to have a film from the region that tells a personal story of the Mideast conflict. It's the often comical, often profoundly sad story of a bride in the Golan Heights trying to cross the border to have her wedding in Syria. Hilarity ensues. Much more coming up, here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now, and we're continuing our conversation with Ari Shavit, a left-leaning Israeli columnist. He interviewed Ariel Sharon for hours in the years before the prime minister's stroke. He writes about these conversations in an article entitled The General in this week's New Yorker magazine. And Ari, how did Ariel Sharon envision the future of a Palestinian state? Was he really going to pull settlements out of the West Bank?
Yes, well, he was careful in about the specifics, but the surprising things about the last meetings I had with him over the last year was that it was still very much the old Sharon. His basic approach was that there's not going to be an end to the conflict, that he did still talk rather frankly about his distrust of Arabs, and yet he was willing to go further. Not to reach peace, because I don't think to his last day as an active politician he believed in real, ideal peace in this generation. He thought that this is going to be a longer process that will take decades. But he was willing to take considerable steps in order to have a border in the West Bank as well, to give the Palestinians a lot of territory on which they can develop their own life, their own political space, and eventually their own independent state. And probably he was willing to uproot at least another 20 settlements in the coming years. Some say that he would have even got to something far more reaching, like 60 or 70 settlements, but we don't know the details of it. But it's clear that he was heading for further concessions, although not believing in an ideal peace in our time.
And by the way, you note he's doing all of this not because of any external pressures, but because he feels it's right for Israel. That always was his benchmark.
Absolutely. First of all, there was nothing politically correct about Mr. Sharon. I think from the day he was born to the day he collapsed. I wouldn't say that he was cruel vis-a-vis Palestinians. He was cruel in his younger days, but as an older statesman. But he cared about the Jews and only about the Jews. But caring about the Jews brought him to understand that he must have international legitimacy and support, definitely the American one. So he, I think, was willing to act and to make concessions in order to prevent the kind of pressure that would be dangerous, as he thought, for Israel.
The thinking, of course, is that even if Ariel Sharon comes back from this devastating stroke, he will not be a player in the future of Israel. The question to you, what is the future of Israel without Sharon? Was he perhaps, as Nixon was the man to go to China, was Sharon perhaps, you know, the best candidate to lead Israel into the future?
Absolutely. What happened to us, again, the liberal and peace-wanting Israelis and others throughout the region with the new Sharon was really almost a political miracle. In a sense, Sharon was, you know, a Barry Goldwater who turned to Senator McCain. He was an outcast right-wing, I don't want to say loony, but really a loose cannon, who became a solid, still conservative, but moderate, rather loved, and radiating stability throughout the area. In this sense, he was an amazing asset. He brought the Israeli public to accept the idea of dealing with occupation, of beginning the process of ending occupation and dismantling at least some of the settlements.
Do you think that Israel can continue this process without him? I mean, how much is it set back?
I think the process is so strong that there is a good chance it will go on, but it will be much more difficult without him because he had the moral authority when it comes to the Israeli right and to the settlers. So to have a person like that making the moderate steps is a great, great contribution to the process. Yeah. While the people who would replace him, the present incoming, you know, the acting prime minister, Mr. Olmert, who would probably be more dovish than Mr. Sharon was, but he doesn't have the same kind of gravitas and he doesn't have the same kind of moral authority to impose his will on the right. So he will probably go the Sharon way, even more so, but I'm afraid that it will be much more difficult. And the danger of having serious Israeli battles, even something coming close to semi-civil war when it comes to the next stage of uprooting settlements in the West Bank, these risks are much higher now without Mr. Sharon as an active political player.
That's a sobering thought to leave us with, Ari Shavit. Civil war in Israel?
I think that the danger that if we will be going to a large-scale evacuation of dozens and dozens of settlements in the West Bank, the hope that it will go as peacefully and elegantly as the disengagement from Gaza is not realistic. I hope it will not be civil war, but it will be much more difficult and much more dangerous. First of all, when it comes to the West Bank, which is a much more sensitive area, and without the historical weight of Mr. Sharon. This is going to be much more tricky, and I'm afraid it might even be bloody.
Ari Shavit, a columnist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. One last question for you. You talk a great length about how Ariel Sharon changed in many ways, but I'm wondering, did you as well?
I went through my own changes. I think that what's interesting is that we all changed in Israel. Basically, what happened in Israel over the last 5 years is that the naive notions of both the right and the left have collapsed. I like to refer to it as the collapse of the messianism, both of the greater Israel and of the greater peace. We've all become much more realistic, much more mature. And in many ways, we find much more in common now because most of us want to get rid of occupation, to get out of at least most of the territories. But most of us realize we will not have ideal peace in this decade, perhaps not in this generation. So what you find now in Israel, and this was defined in the Sharon era, but it's still with us as the Sharon era ends, is that I think most Israelis, 70-80% of Israelis changed, leaving behind them the naive idealism of both right and left and finding themselves in a sort of center that does not have that many illusions.
Israeli columnist Ari Shavit. His article on Ariel Sharon, entitled The General, appears in this week's New Yorker. It's fascinating reading. Ari, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And stay with us. There is much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now. Here and Now. The debate over physician-assisted suicide is heating up after this week's Supreme Court decision turning back a Bush administration bid to block the Oregon law that allows doctors to help terminally ill patients die. Since Oregon's Death with Dignity Act took effect in 1997 through 2004, state officials say 208 people have died with the help of their doctors. Statistics for 2005 are due next month. Similar proposals have been considered in California and Hawaii, and lawmakers in Vermont will take it up again this year. So today we're going to hear from doctors on both sides of the debate in the Green Mountain State. First, a supporter of physician-assisted suicide. Dr. Diana Barnard is a practicing family physician in Middlebury, Vermont. And Dr. Barnard, do you think the Supreme Court decision on Oregon this week will boost the physician-assisted suicide effort where you are in Vermont?
Well, I do. I think that we've had the legislation pending now for a couple of sessions, and I think with this Supreme Court case, there was some concern that perhaps if the decision was negative, that there would be no need for us to push forward with the legislation. But now that we have strong support for the idea, I'm hopeful that we'll continue to move forward with our momentum.
I know that public hearings have been held since the legislation was first proposed. What do people say?
Well, what people say depends on who you talk to. There are lots of Vermonters, a strong majority. The most recent poll we have showed 78% of Vermonters support the idea of being able to make their own decisions on how they end their life. So the public, I think, strongly supports the idea. There's a variety of physician opinion on the idea, which I think, you know, is understandable. But the bottom line is that this bill is not about physicians or providers. It's really about patients. And in that regard, Vermonters strongly support the concept and want to see this bill pass.
But what do you say to your patients or people who might come up to you and say, I worry about this. I worry that this could lead to, you know, the killing of people who are disabled or handicapped. You know, the concerns about end of life.
Well, I think the beauty of the legislation that's been introduced in Vermont is that it's very closely patterned after the legislation out of Oregon, where we have 10 years of experience now showing that carefully crafted legislation with important safeguards can assure that this is a situation that will be used by a very few number of patients who face intolerable suffering, and that the safeguards assure that none of the nightmare scenarios that our opponents have feared might happen have taken place. So we have 10 years of real life experience in Oregon that tells us that this legislation can work and can work very well, not only for the very few number of patients who use it, but to everybody that dies, knowing that they won't have to face interminable suffering at the end of their lives.
You mentioned something important because we are reminded that very few people have actually taken advantage of this law in Oregon. It's just more knowing that it's there if you do need it. It has been another impact of the law. But what else have you learned from Oregon?
Well, we've learned that the passage of this legislation has improved all aspects of end-of-life care. Less than 1% of deaths in Oregon have made use of this legislation, but the vast majority of patients who make use of it are on hospice care and have access to all of the support which we want dying patients to have. I really believe that passing this legislation has pushed forward patient rights and really encourage providers to do everything possible to keep our patients comfortable at the end of life and really face the many myriad of symptoms that can happen and try to support them as much as possible in all aspects.
In other words, just having this law, and we've heard this from others in Oregon, has led to more palliative care, more hospice care, and more care in general just about end of life.
I think it really raises the issue to a more public standing. Death happens to all of us, and yet the amount of time and energy that medical students and residents and even practicing physicians spend on the subject with their patients is woefully small. And I think, again, Oregon clearly shows us that that this legislation is part of very good end-of-life care.
Diana Barnard is a family practitioner in Middlebury, Vermont, and a supporter of physician-assisted suicide. Well, we turn now to Dr. Robert Orr. He's president of the Vermont Alliance for Ethical Healthcare, which opposes physician-assisted suicide. And Dr. Orr, I know you think the Supreme Court ruling this week was a very narrow one and will not give the right to die movement any momentum. But what is your argument against physician-assisted suicide?
The consequences of this, I think, are terrible. With expansions and abuses and complications. We've seen this in the Netherlands, and we're beginning to see in Oregon, and there really is no need for this if we work hard to improve the quality of end-of-life care that we provide to patients.
And how do you say that you're seeing problems? Where are you seeing problems with this, in Oregon, for instance?
For instance, there are patients who are unable to swallow the pills themselves, who are getting help from family members. There are people with dementia who really don't have the capacity to make their own decisions, who are being urged and pushed in this direction by family members. There are people with depression who are hospitalized for depression, and the psychiatrist allows them to keep their lethal prescription. And these are all clearly against the law.
But we're not seeing a flood of people wanting to kill themselves, as some detractors predicted.
Well, I don't know what you would consider a flood, and I don't know that we know exactly how many are happening, but I think one patient taking their life prematurely is a sad indictment of the medical profession.
I'm wondering further, do you think we're focusing on the wrong thing? I mean, what would you want to see for end-of-life care?
I would like to see improved access to good pain management, good symptom control, good psychological support, good spiritual counsel for everybody who is confronting this illness and this situation and for their families. Good hospice care, good palliative care. It's really, physicians are not adequately prepared to do this.
Dr. Robert Orr, president of the Vermont Alliance for Ethical Healthcare. And as we said, Doctor, Vermont is considering legislation that would make assisted suicide legal, something you're opposed to. Do you have a sense of how this Supreme Court decision might have impacted legislators?
I think it's going to have little impact. The chairperson of the House Human Services Committee, where this bill has currently been sitting for the last year, reported just to one of our members just recently, after reading the decision, that it would not have any bearing on the timing or the approach of her committee. Mm-hmm. Her committee has looked at this bill, has held hearings, and she has said that they will continue discussion of it after town meeting in March. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that this decision is going to have the impact that some people portray.
Right. And it might not happen as soon as some think in Vermont. But if it does happen, if it's made legal in Vermont, what will you do if one of your patients asks you to help them?
I will try to determine, as I do now, I will try to determine what is it that's making life unbearable and what can I do to make it better. Is it pain? Is it vomiting? Is it nausea? Is it lack of sleep? Is it social isolation? Is it spiritual distress? What can we do to make things better today and tomorrow and next week?
But if they ask you to help them end their life, to, as a physician, assist their suicide?
I'm unable to do that.
Dr. Robert Orr, again, president of the Vermont Alliance for Ethical Healthcare. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for calling.
And still to come, a movie made by an Israeli, co-written by a Palestinian, about a Syrian bride living in the Golan Heights. Taking notes? You're listening to Here and Now. Well, Well, it's down to four teams, and one thing's for certain, there will be a new Super Bowl champion this year. After breaking the hearts of New England fans by beating last year's champs, the Patriots, last week, the Denver Broncos will host the surprise Pittsburgh Steelers in the AFC Championship game this Sunday. On the NFC side, the top-ranked Seattle Seahawks are taking on the Carolina Panthers. And here to talk all things football and perhaps other rackets is only a game host, Bill Littlefield. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Robin.
And the Pittsburgh Steelers, are, as you know, are trying to become only the second team since the 1985 Patriots. Yay. to make it to the Super Bowl by winning three games on the road. Now, they stunned the Indianapolis Colts last week. Are the Pittsburgh Steelers everyone's favorite underdog, but with an accent on underdog?
They're my favorite underdog, Robin, because this week their quarterback, Ben Roethlisberger, said, as crazy as it may be, you know the way some people have those bracelets that say, what would Jesus do? Sometimes I find myself thinking, what would Jerome do? And he's referring to Jerome Bettis, the running back on the Steelers. They're friends. They like each other. They depend on each other. I hope they win.
Well, and let's move on to the Seattle versus Panthers game. The Seattle Seahawks running back Sean Alexander, also the league MVP, will play against the Panthers, despite having a concussion, getting a concussion in last week's game. And the Seattle's right tackle Sean Locklear is due to play despite legal troubles. He spent 2 days in jail on a domestic violence charge. Can the Seahawks play with all these distractions?
I don't know. But the more important message to me, the more important matter to me is, what is the message that the National Football League is sending into those millions of homes where the game will be on TV? Two messages. One, shake off that concussion and get back out there on the field. That's a very bad message to send to anybody, kids or adults. And the second is, Yeah, domestic violence. Let's put it off until after the team is eliminated from the playoffs or wins the Super Bowl. And that's another message that's a little bit on the sketchy side. This isn't a joke.
Two days in jail.
No, exactly. And, the fellow who allegedly committed the violence has apologized apparently to everybody except the victim of the violence. He apologized to his coach and his teammates and the whole city of Seattle and everybody who roots for his team. But apparently not to the woman who was the victim. So it's two very bad messages, and I'm sure the National Football League is upset, but not upset enough to step in and say, hey, you know what? This is probably a bad idea.
Yeah. Okay, comparative question. Both Denver and Pittsburgh are teams that have had, a lot of Super Bowl appearances and wins. But over on the NFC side, aside from the Panthers, who lost to the Patriots, in Super Bowl 2003, they just don't have that experience and the history. Is that a reflection of the imbalance of the AFC and the NFC?
I don't really buy that. The imbalance, it seems to me, was between the New England Patriots and everybody else in three of the last 4 years, and the Denver Broncos addressed that imbalance by dispatching the Patriots, albeit with the help of the Patriots, who played in an uncharacteristically unpatriotic way, in football terms at least.
We've said that we're just in honor and as a salute to our hometown football team, we're just dropping things. I mean, we're just throwing them on the floor
One, was astonished they decided to go on with the postseason. I kind of felt when the Patriots were eliminated, everybody would pack up and go home and watch basketball.
But no.
No.
But actually, many have switched over to tennis, and I do want to ask you about the Australian Open. It's being held this week. On the men's side, the hometown favorite lost. Leighton Hewitt was defeated by the Argentinian Juan Chela, who some might remember spit at Hewitt last year, causing quite drama. But this was just sort of a quiet loss.
Yeah, it was a quiet loss. But my good friend Bud Collins has assured me that everybody has a wonderful time at the Australian Open, no matter what happens. And I'm sure that the Aussies in attendance will get their get their groove back and enjoy the rest of the tournament. Hewitt's absence notwithstanding.
And I know you, of all people, want to mention the women. Martina Hingis looks like she's playing well. And who's left of the Williams sisters?
Well, Serena is left. Venus is gone via first-round loss. But the Martina Hingis story is a great story. People forget when she was forced out, she was a kid. She's still only 25 years old, and so to see her come back, I think, is a great story.
It's a terrific story, and one we'll go into at greater depth later.
Excellent.
Only Game host Bill Littlefield. Be sure and catch his program on the weekends on your public radio station. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. here and now. Well, we began the program today with news of a suicide bombing in Tel Aviv, adding to the tensions in the Middle East, a conflict that plays out in a very personal way in a new award-winning fiction film from Israel. The Syrian Bride tells the story of a young Syrian woman living in the Golan Heights, a region occupied by Israel since 1967, but not recognized as Israel's by Syria. This puts her pro-Syrian family with Israeli passports in the middle of a sort of no man's land. The film plays as a rural domestic comedy, sort of My Big Fat Greek Wedding with Slaughtered Lamb. It's also profoundly sad at times, because Mona, who's engaged to a Syrian cousin she knows only from his daytime TV soap opera, will never see her family again if she crosses the border into Syria for her wedding. And The Syrian Bride touches on issues beyond the conflict in the region, such as racism, sexism, and the generational divide. Aaron Rickless is the director. He's an Israeli Jew who made his film in Arabic, co-wrote it with a Palestinian-Israeli screenwriter, and cast it with mostly Palestinian-Israelis. Aaron Rickless joins us from the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. And Aaron, your film is all about borders and boundaries on a number of levels. Can you just sketch out the storyline for us?
Every person wakes up everywhere in the world, wakes up every morning and has to decide, you know, which borders or boundaries does he cross today or he doesn't. And if he does, you know, does he bear the consequences? So that's really what interested me in this context. And in terms of the story, it's really, you know, it's a classical family situation. We're talking about a Druze family at the Golan Heights, but this could be your family, could be my family, and that's the way I approached it.
Druze, a religious minority, mainly make up the Golan Heights, see themselves as Muslim?
Well, they're an offspring of Islam, really, and they live in Syria and the Golan Heights, which, you know, it's debatable whether it's Syrian or Israeli, and in Lebanon and in Israel itself. And the curious thing is that in Israel, in fact, they're totally loyal to Israel and actually serve in the Israeli army, and the Palestinians hate them. So it's a kind of really kind of, you know, chaotic situation, I think, as far as the Druze go. But, you know, I wasn't setting out to do an anthropological film. I kind of felt that, you know, these are people who really, in a nutshell, represent everything I want to discuss in terms of, you know, the actual situation and beyond that. And I think everything you see in the film in terms of the relationships within the family and the relationships within the village and, you know, the broader kind of politics, both local and international, are things that I kind of witnessed and I really experienced throughout my 2 or 3 years of, you know, running around that area. But on the other hand, I could sit at home and probably imagine all this because it's, you know, it works the same way in Ireland, Korea, and for that matter, in Manhattan. You know, it doesn't really matter.
Let's explain some of those universal truths. The father, very pro-Syrian, in fact, spent some time in prison. He can't go to the border to see his daughter off because the police are watching him. The father has a son who's been banned because the son married a Russian. Mm-hmm. A daughter who is having problems with her husband. She wants to go to school in Israel. And so she's sort of on the outs as well. It's not as if there's one unified family with one opinion.
You probably take all the stuff that Shakespeare wrote and just mix it, and you get, you know, to what you were just mentioning, because, you know, it's both Romeo and Juliet and it's Hamlet and it's loads of things dealing with, you know, kids and parents and relationships within the family and outside the family, and, you know, codes of honor, which are very strong, obviously, in the Middle East and especially in the Druze society, where, you know, if the eldest son goes off and marries a Russian woman, that's it, you know, it's the end of the world. I think the film is really about, you know, on one hand, the kind of static situation which we encounter in the Middle East day to day. On the other hand, it is about changes in the Middle East, which we also encounter day to day. And that's why I like to refer to this film as a kind of optimistic film, which is really, you know, a little bit optimistic, a little bit pessimistic. And a kind of, you know, if you get the right mixture between the two, you get the true picture of this area.
The Israeli police officer... Mm-hmm. It's one of probably the most unsympathetic characters in the film. But even in him, you can see a struggle between doing his job and trying to help the family, giving into appeals from her family. For instance, that the father be allowed to go to the border. The film opens, takes place on the day that Bashar al-Assad comes to power, the current president of Syria, and there's a demonstration, and the bride's father is marching in the demonstration, and the Israeli officer says, don't do this. Don't march, because I have to arrest you, and it's your daughter's wedding day. There's conflict there.
Ahmed, go home. Your daughter is married.
Go! 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 Go!
You know, for me, a lot of Israelis, or a lot of actually, you know, Israelis in the States ask me about this character because obviously, you know, he's kind of tricky. On one hand, he's a cop, you know, he's like a cop everywhere. He's tough. He wants to get his job done. On the other hand, he has his moment of grace where you know, he lets the father off. So I think this is true of all the characters in the film. You know, I was kind of trying to get my stereotypes right, you know, in the sense that everybody represents something, but on the other hand, he only represents himself. And so all these people are, you know, they're true to life, and they obviously kind of really represent a lot of other people who are involved in this conflict. But, you know, they're people. And as an optimist, in the end, my approach was, you know, every person here has his moment of grace. And not many people, I think, whatever they do in life, can resist this image of a bride at the border, you know, trying to get married. You know, it's a very simple and touching image, and, you know, you can't say no to that.
Fully dressed in her outfit, which she's been in for the duration of the film, trying to wait for all of this to be resolved, and now she's at the border in her beautiful white gown and going back and forth between the checkpoints because the Israelis have put an Israeli stamp on her passport, but the Syrians won't accept it. And into this mix, some other characters come, a Red Cross worker who there's a flirtation between one of the sons and the aid workers. But in any event, that's another story. The Red Cross worker has a conversation with a Syrian border officer as the Red Cross worker tries to help the bride get across. Let's listen.
I told you already, as far as I'm concerned, she comes from Syria and she's going to Syria. She didn't come from Israel.
But what am I supposed to do? Tell me. People are waiting on the other side, on your side too?
I have no idea. It's their problem, not ours. You know, the whole thing is part of an Israeli policy of declaring that the Golan belongs to them. We will never agree to that. You can tell them that.
Aaron Rickless, what would you say to those who might just have a superficial glance at this film and say, this is a film about what the Israelis have done to the poor minorities living in the Golan Heights?
I would say forget that. You know, it's not about politics. It's about, you know, a family situation, and it's about tensions within a family. And you know, I think these tensions and these conflicts and all these issues that the film discusses are close to anyone who has a heart, you know, because I think in the Middle East, but I think it's true today, it was always true, but I think today it's especially true that everything you do, everything you look at is political, wherever you live. You know, the world has become very political. Now, it was also political, you know, in the days of the Greek Empire or the Roman Empire, but I think today the influence of decisions taken by, you know, people in remote places like, you know, the White House or the Kremlin or other places like that in the world have, you know, a direct effect on the lives of people who, you know, all they want to do is, you know, get married, love, hate, whatever. So I think really the film is really about that, you know, and that's why when I say it's not political, I'm not saying that naively. Of course it's political, but it's only political because it deals with an issue which has immediate kind of results, you know, on a wedding day.
Israeli director Aaron Rickless, his film The Syrian Bride opens in Boston tomorrow. It'll be showing across the country in the coming months. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.